What can I say? I've been trying to find this in the I've been trying to find this intersection of art and science, I think my whole adult life, or art and math, and only in the last couple of years I've been able to articulate it, even to myself. So I'm hoping to get through what I want to say to you quickly so that maybe we can talk a little bit. I couldn't follow a more perfect presentation than what we just saw, and I'll get to why that was perfect other than it was elegant, and that's what, at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. But when I try to tell my friends or my mother or my aunts, which is really hard, that what I'm doing, I say this, that until the computer came along, there was only two ways to make music or to have music in your life. You either took time out of your life and mastered an instrument, or you went down to Tower Records and you bought a CD. And the computer now is going to fill in that gap. There's now going to be a continuum of experiences that go between mastering the instrument and buying the CD. So, for example, Guitar Hero, I don't know if you're familiar or not, it's a game, it's a little plastic guitar, it's got four notes on it, and the notes come at you like you're in an Indianapolis 500, and if you happen to steer your car and hit the note, then, you know, some pre-recorded guitarist, and I think the most recent version of this actually has Metallica records, you know, that, I see everyone who's nodding has a child that has this thing, I bet. The good news is, as unmusical as that experience is in some ways, I know lots of young kids who are now playing real guitars because someone gave them Guitar Hero. And that same family had no idea how to give their child a guitar, but they knew how to give him a video game. So there is some good news in this video game thing. All right, so now I'm going to come back to this logic, but just to give you an idea of where I'm at, and I must say quite humbly, I am at the place that Dimitri wants to say is nowhere, and I readily agree with him, that all I'm doing is taking some numbers and mapping it naively into music. And I'm going to say more about that, about what's right and wrong about that. But just to let you know how I've done it, in 2001, when Stephen Wolfram's New Kind of Science came out, and there was this book, 1,200-page book with all these patterns in it, the first thing I said to myself, I wonder what these patterns sound like. So I whipped this up, and a really fun piece of software called Max MSP. I whipped this up. So this is one of Stephen's cellular automata, and we're now mapping that with this little white thing I call an agent. It's crawling around, you know. This white thing is being blown up here, right above the keyboard. It has sampled two black pixels. There's two blue pixels, two black, and you can see that this is being mapped very directly. I guess that's three black pixels. It's being mapped very directly onto the keyboard and sounds really awful. Right? Now this is where my music friends, as I start to improve my lot in life here, because I've taken this fairly beautiful graphical picture and I've turned it into absolute crap, you know, as music, right? So now I'm just going to start applying anything I can do to make it sound better. Right. So the first thing I want to do is I want to pick what musicians would call a pitch set. That is, musicians who've gone to school. Trust me, musicians who don't go to school don't know it's a pitch set. But I'm going to take the pentatonic scale, and if ever these red notes hit something that's not in the pitch set, I'm not going to play it. So I'm going to turn that off. I'm already on our way to something that's beautiful, right? And I'm gonna make no bones about it. My goal in life is to pursue beauty. Okay. So, in other words, I'm not per se pursuing insight, I'm pursuing beauty. But they're wrapped up in some deep, deep way. So there you have it. I mean, at this point, there's millions of things we could do. We could start changing the pitch set periodically. Something in trying to create layers of involvement. I have this little thing now. Notice there's this, look over here. So now I have this thing that's sampling the cellular automata, but then I have this other thing that's sampling that sample space. And I thought maybe part of existence in this universe is about sort of these layers of abstraction or hierarchy. And so this little thing is going back and forth inside my agent, and whenever it happens to intersect something that's already black, you know, so this becomes, from a musician's point of view, this becomes a nice generator for a bass line or a melody. Whereas the other, without that feature, you know, I'm in sort of this more rhythm chord spacey kind of place. Now let me just real quick.
Susan, who's moving your agent?
It's moving randomly.
Okay.
And, but that's my goal. My goal is to give people, again, if we go back to that other picture, this is my goal. My goal is to create something in the middle that you don't have to spend 6 years of your life, you know, 2 hours a day to start making a musical experience. I want to, like, figure out a way for the computer and you to start having an experience. So I'm looking to invent, so the short answer is I'm looking to invent ways of finger painting my way to music, right? So I can pick this up and start finger painting my way to music, right? I'm teaching myself to program the iPhone because it hit me over the head the other day when one of my employees' little two-year-old daughter, to calm her down, he gave her his iPhone. And she opened it up, she went to her app, she had her little finger hit the wrong app, she closed that app, she went back to the springboard, I think they call it, found her app again, and got started. And she's 2 years old. And I'm saying, wait a minute, where have I been? This is the musical toy that I've been waiting for. So I have every intention of start inventing lots of finger paint your way to music. And inside that computer, inside that is going to be an awful lot of mathematics. So the question is, the subtle question is, what is this sophisticated mapping between numbers, math, and music. So I'll be glad to show you more of this. This piece of software was an attempt to like just get lots of ideas going. So none of them are sophisticated. But I can tell you at the first New Kind of Science exhibit when I put this up on the screen and everyone had seen these patterns and I hit play, there was like a gasp in the room. Like people hadn't thought, what does this stuff sound like? Nor, they're so used to, this is time is moving down the page, but when you look at these things, you forget the time's involved, and so, because it's this two-dimensional geometric thing. But you can't listen to music except in time. So it was this reminder that this stuff was with time. Yeah?
How many octaves do you have on that keyboard?
I don't know, because in the world of synthesizers, the keyboard is such an obvious input device that you use it to represent things other than notes. So I just probably chose this huge range so that part of the keyboard could be involved with changing, you know, instruments, and part of it would be the notes, and you know.
I just wondered if you were going to produce 16 hertz
No. All right, so let's...
Or 8,090. I'd like to hear that.
All right, so that's the show and tell part of the... Let me get on with my message or my quandary. There's even my aunt, who still doesn't understand what I'm trying to do with my life, knows that there's some sort of rhyme between math and music, right? And this is the naive model that I think all of us succumb to, is that there's math, there's music, we ought to just invent this thing in the middle and we're all set. My partner and I want to suggest that we need to get a little more subtle in our thinking. That the first thing we might want to do is notice that there's math, and then there's theories about math. And if we start at the other end, there's music, and then there's theories about music. That box still is in the middle, and it might be easier or more potent for us to notice that mapping or rhyme that we're looking for there in box three has something more subtly to do with these mapping of these two theories about the endpoints, and that the endpoint of music and math are actually a little further apart than we think. Okay, so we love to toy with the words objective, subjective in that middle space, and explicit and implicit in that middle space, and I'll get to all of that in just a second. What do I really want to say to you this morning is, what is this nature of inquiry? And that leads me to this, the PPR cycle. I don't know if this is what other people call this. I ran into this in the late 70s in artificial intelligence. Someone said this is what artificial intelligence is. It's production, perception, reflection. Your robot or your computer program does something, some other part of the process in the computer perceives what has been done, and then a decision gets made, and then that cycle returns. So there's this thing called the PPR cycle. My partner, Paul Burdick, who couldn't be here today, who's at the New England Conservatory of Music, he ran into it at Howard Gardner's Project Zero, I think it's called, at Harvard, where they're trying to create manipulables for grade school kids. And their whole thing is built on production, perception, reflection. Give the kids something that they do, teach them how to perceive the results, and then get them thinking about, you know, what has just happened so that they do something else. It's an insanely simple thing that I use all over the place. I got off the subway this morning and noticed that on April something at Rutgers University had the Play, Explore, Learn Day. And it's the same process. Play, do something, explore, perceive, make some observations, learn from that, and then do it again. So this PPR cycle is out there hiding in many different forms. In the world of philosophy, it is the good, the true, and the beautiful. Okay, let me just back up here. Let me start with perception. Perception is beautiful, reflection is the true, and sort of a hard one to understand the mapping, the production and morals, or the good. And I even kind of cheapen that a bit and notice that's the business world. The business world is all about making stuff. And I'll say more about that in a minute. So morality, art, science is, in some ways, the PPR cycle. Here's another set of words that I want to get in your heads. The concept of a percept as opposed to a concept. Concept is a word we sort of hear a lot. Percept is a bit of a rare word. So I want to take a moment to get that in your head, because this is a key to getting my rhyme that I'm trying to sell you guys. Mm-hmm. And then action, okay? So keep all that spinning on, like on the old Ed Sullivan show. Remember when the guys would come out and start spinning this plate? So I want to believe I got one plate up and spinning, the PPR cycle. I now want to talk about life in the universe. There's a way, I think this is called the perennial tradition. I think William James, in his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, called this the perennial tradition. That there's some sort of body, mind, spirit way that we're in this universe. There's these levels of existence. at some low level is just our bodies, just being physical. Then there's the, some sort of notion of perception that we share with the entire living world, whether they're plants or you know, animals. And then there's our thinking, our rational thinking. And I'm not saying that animals don't think. All of this is present all the time. But there is a way to look at this. Now, one of the problems with this thinking, this hierarchical thinking, there's a way that concept always wins the day. The minute you say it's action, percept, concept, somehow concept is what gets valued over percept. And I don't want that to happen. So now, back to PPR. We could notice that we could have a form of inquiry that's what I would call percept-driven versus concept-driven versus moral action-driven. And let me just see. Yes. So I want to propose that doing music and doing math is the exact same process. It's going around this PPR cycle. The difference being, where do you win? Where is the resting point? Where is the point from which your thinking is sort of grounded? In music, I'm going to propose that it's percept-driven. In math, it's concept-driven. So what I want to say is that if you're a mathematician, you collect your paycheck at concept. You collect your paycheck when you go around the board and you come up with a theory that explains something or people buy into. As opposed to musicians could care less about theory, that we are percept driven. Our paycheck comes when you take that brush, dip it in the red paint, and you scrape it across the canvas and say, oh my God, right? Or you put your fingers down on the keyboard and you play a C major chord and you play an F sharp and you say, oh my God, you know. That's the payoff. And this is the start of misunderstanding why these efforts in music and math are having troubles kind of having a healthy synchronicity, is that we're doing the same thing, but our paychecks are in different places. So science and math is conceptually based inquiry. Art is perceptually based inquiry. So remember, here's our five boxes. Remember, we're trying to figure out what is the nature of this middle box. There's all the stuff. Here's what I want to suggest is our five. It took my partner and I we had this notion of spreading these boxes out and noticing that it might be a little more subtle than we first thought. And then we noticed that the boxes weren't quite right. If we actually notice that music theory is nothing more than looking for that conceptual reward in the PPR cycle. So here is music with its percept-driven focus. And then some theorist comes along and says, I want to think about what you're doing, but put the focus on concept. Over here in the world of math, you have the data, you know, that you're looking at, which in a way is percept-driven, and you create concepts. So the thing is, again, is this emphasis that the thing that works out of the box in music is the percept. And there's this venture into the concept of talking about it. Over here in math, the natural thing, the natural home is in the concept, and you sort of refer back to the percept, you know, casually, or, you know, I don't want to diminish any part of the process, but loosely, this is what I'm saying. Now, just so we're all thinking in the same way, and you can correct me when I'm wrong here. So a typical strategy in math is induction, where you start with basically an indefensible A. You just say, this is my definition, you know, a point, a line, boom, boom. And from there, B follows, C follows, D follows. I first heard this from a professor I had at college, Giancarlo Roda, just a wonderful mathematician. And he said mathematics was the art of drawing necessary conclusions. So this is the math process. You start with an indefensible definition, and you say, I don't need to defend this. This is I'm claiming that this to be true, and then something follows. That's not at all what artists do. Artists, there might be a first position, but what there really is, there's the continuation forms a chain or a loop, and it's a perceptual whole right from the start. So the goal in artistic induction, if you will, is refining that those relationships, but in this whole unified circular way, if you will. There's a lovely essay. Heidegger's got an essay called "On the Work of Art," where he takes on the whole issue of what is a work of art. And I won't go into any of that, but right from the start, he realizes he's caught in a vicious circle of definitions. And he says, but I want to suggest that it's not a vicious circle, it's a virtuous circle. That there's something very real and natural about circular thinking. And this is the world that artists live inside of. So now I want to talk about success in these two domains of thinking. When math is successful in its explicit linear way, we look for some sort of reinforcement in its implicit whole way. And when we find that, suddenly the math becomes beautiful. I have this little whole thing set aside with Pythagorean's theorem, which maybe we can get to, maybe we won't, but any theory, I think right now we're sort of living through this era where Fermat's last theorem has been proved, but no one will claim that the proof is beautiful yet, that somehow it needs to sit inside some larger whole in a way that's going to satisfy us. So my point is that in the world of math, rational, explicit thinking, we look for that reinforcement in this implicit, holistic way. And when we find it, we say it's beautiful, we say it's art. The art world sort of operates the opposite way. Once we have the wholeness, and now we're looking for a feature that reveals its linear success in a way that's what Dimitri has done so beautifully for us. By making some notable observations about even though we're talking about discrete objects, 12 objects, let's get them back in the continuous plane, and some pretty beautiful stuff falls out of that, and might even explain the success of Chopin's music. We already knew the music was successful, you know, but now we actually might have a linear explanation, a mathematical explanation of where that success is coming from. So often I tend to exist in negative space all the time. I always think of disease situations, but in my world of music, there's this stuff called Muzak, or elevator music, which isn't music at all. It just happens to use the same process that real music has been. And the problem is, or you can start noticing what's wrong about Muzak by taking it apart mathematically and follow the induction backwards to that arbitrary first point, and that's the problem with it. You actually get back to a point that was quite arbitrary. It was arbitrary in its arbitrariness, you know. There was nothing whole about the process of music. And so, which is why it's not beautiful. So in math, you're basically done when you've figured out what's been left out. And when you figure out what's been left out, it clicks, it's beautiful, it's art. In art, you're done when you figured out what can't be left out. You can't possibly live without this one brushstroke. this one note, this one chord, you know? So, all right, so that's sort of what I wanted to say. I'd like to stop here and get some questions or, you know, queries or whatever. Yes?
So I understand your distinction, your precept-concept distinction with respect to art or music, but I didn't understand your precept-concept distinction between that and that theory.
Well,
between music and music theory, I want to say. I don't understand the distinction between that and that theory.
There is definitely there's definitely something that happens in the universe that is not math per se, but it is the data from which the math comes from. So we could talk about how many head of cattle you own, and then we could say, well, we need a concept to talk about how many head, so we invent numbers, right? So the numbers are, the numbers is not the percept. The numbers is are the notion of numbers, ordinal, cardinal numbers, is the concept. The percept was the head of cattle, or the percept was noticing that we could start counting. So the percept and math are these the actual things, whether they're physical reality or abstract realities. That's the percept. Does that make sense?
Or? Yeah, it makes sense. Although I don't like the word math already implies, to my mind, theory. So maybe it's really reality versus math as opposed to math versus math.
Well, now you've said a mouthful there, because that's what I want to remind you all you mathematicians who are trying to do artful things. I want to help you take that apart a little bit and get back to noticing that this sort of gets back to that other chart I have of body, mind, spirit, or physical action, perception, conception, that if we're going to find really good mappings and resonance with the art world, we've got to go back and notice that within our math world that is so chauvinistic on concept, that there's actually, there's percept in there, and I got to get you noticing that again, or you're not going to help us artists create tools or to create insight until you start seeing that rhyme. Yeah?
Let me interrupt just for a second. I'm wondering if we can have the next speaker set up while you continue to field questions.
Yes?
I'm wondering, is increasing mathematics basically a built on patterns, recognizing patterns.
Yes.
And then once you recognize a very nice pattern, then you try to find out why it works, and then you enter the theory.
Mm-hmm.
But the first step is finding the pattern.
And so you're helping me answer this man's question, that's the percept is the pattern, right?
And that's often not, that's never addressed in mathematics course. We only deal with the theory of pattern.
Right.
Well,
yes, and I would say that Stephen Wolfram's trying to cure that, because that's where he wants to start with patterns, and that's his whole thing, his new kind of science is not grounded in mathematical thinking, it's grounded in patterns, of which math is one way of getting at those patterns. In conversations with Stephen, he said, he's really surprised that the mathematicians haven't noticed yet that he's saying that all math is an invention of the human mind. He's definitely on that side of the table, that what the universe gives us is patterns, that it's the human mind. But again, we're now in this tautology that the human mind is the universe too, you know. So it's, as Friedman Dyson, it's all this, it's infinite in all directions, and it's all this all at the same time. So, but it's on a casual way of discussing it. The universe gives us patterns. Math is an invention of the human mind. So I agree with you totally.
You might also say that the mathematician has to take the patterns to internal states, whereas the artist takes those patterns to external.
Okay, I like that. Yes.
I disagree. I think the universe gives us constraints, and I believe that patterns are the emergent behavior of those constraints.
I must have, in undergraduate school, when we came upon boundary value problems, I just loved them. I said, this is the coolest thing. You've got this thing, and all of a sudden, it becomes many different things depending on where you put the walls, so to speak, you know. I would, perhaps that's a way of looking at the universe.
It's sort of like positive negative space.
Exactly. And that's the whole artist journey right there, is, you know, what are you calling the self, you know? And the self can only be defined by non-self. So, you know, that goes out and that shrinks in, and so we should talk more about that. But no, because this is at the heart of this issue. It's just that. Yeah,
one more.
I just had to try and find the name of the article, but I've been thinking of it in a lot of the discussions. It's called Lockhart's Lament, and he's a mathematician, and he writes about the beauty of math as an art, and then does almost the opposite and talks about how what a mathematician does when they create a proof and they discover these patterns that are within, they interpret these patterns by being human, not necessarily already having existed, and goes and then compares it to that of the artist. Instead of it's an interesting article that talks about the beauty of mathematics, almost in a very similar way that you're.
I would love to ask each one of you, what was the day when you realized that you loved math? You know, I'm not sure what day it was for me, but it could have been the day that someone wrote E=i(θ = -1. And you do the Taylor expansion of that, and everything drops out, and move it. And you just sit there, and you say, oh my God, you know, right? I don't know what day it was that's the day that I realized that math was beauty and was art. I am definitely, I am an artist, I mean a musician, I'm a mathematician pretending to be a musician. Absolutely. The beauty is in the math for me. Now, I love the fact that I spent 30 years being a musician, but I went to the dictionary this morning because I knew we were going to talk about beauty, and this was the definition, at least of one dictionary. Beauty is the quality present in a thing that gives intense or deep satisfaction to the mind, which I thought was a really kind of clever way of avoiding any sort of argument, but I do find this a good definition, that beauty is the quality present in a thing that gives intense or deep satisfaction to the mind. So, all right, well,
thank you.